Morning, everyone.
You should remind them what time it is.
Yes, it's actually 10 o'clock. Three out of the four of us, our hotel didn't wake us up at the right time. So, I thank you very much for being here this early, especially on a Sunday morning. My name is Joshua Porter. I run a blog and a consultancy at Bocardo.com. And as many of you may have noticed, we have some different panelists than were on the description.
I'm Emily.
We're missing Emily Chang and Max Kiesler. They actually shot us an email last night and said that they had some urgent family issues to attend to back home. So they wanted to apologize for not being here. Thankfully, as Daniel and I were chatting, we ran into some great guys to have on the panel. So
they haven't shown up yet, though.
they'll be here in an hour. Just want to quickly let them introduce themselves, and then we'll jump right in.
So my name is Chris Messina. I run a consultancy called Citizen Agency. I've been involved in the Bar Camp and co-working communities, as well as microformats and OpenID and OAuth. And a lot of our consulting actually deals with social strategies and social media design and getting our clients actually into communities and things like that. So that's kind of my background and interest in this stuff. Also, I was trained actually as a communication designer. So my background sort of actually in interaction design and HCI.
Hi, my name is Daniel Burka. I'm the creative director at DIG, and I'm also one of the co-founders of a site called Pounce. And way back, I was also a co-founder of a Canadian web development company called Silver Orange in Eastern Canada.
My name is Todd Sealing. I'm an interaction designer and web strategist out of Vancouver, BC. And for the past 3 years, I've been mostly working with Magnolia.com and Larry Helf in building that social bookmarking site.
Great, thanks. So social design strategies, we're talking here today about something that we call social design and the strategies surrounding that. And to give you just a little background on kind of where we see the space, we're kind of in one way you could look at the web, we're in a third phase. The first phase was that when you published static HTML websites and you could essentially just read them. It was one-way communication between the publisher and the person reading it. The second phase, which happened in the mid-90s or so, when web applications came on the scene and you attached a database on the back end, and then the site could save your information. So it started to be a two-way communication between an individual and the site. So, for example, banking sites and e-commerce sites are great examples of those. In the last few years, especially the last 3 years, we've seen an amazing rise of social web applications, which go even beyond regular web applications in that they enable communication between the people using the software. So, of course, the big examples are Facebook and MySpace, the social networks. We also have a ton of sites that you could call object-based social networks like Flickr, Delicious, YouTube, where people upload objects of some sort, share them. There's a whole social aspect around there. So what we're talking about, we have like the real leading thinkers in that space, are the design issues that come over time as you see more and more social interaction between the people using your website. These are often counterintuitive, very hard to predict, and so what we're going to be talking about are really concrete problems that we've seen and solutions to some of those problems. And some of our takes are a little different on some of these issues, so hopefully we can surface those. Another thing is that for anyone who has a question, please ask the questions at the microphone. So the recording will come out great and so everyone will hear you. You can ask questions at any time. We found that if one person tends to have a question, other people tend to have the same question. So please feel free to talk back to us at any point. So I'm going to, at the beginning, we're going to do three quick little presentations and then open it up to a broader discussion. And at that point, Chris will kind of moderate and kind of manage the discussion at that point. So I'm going to first talk about one of the big challenges, of designing social websites, and that's how do you encourage good behavior? So in other words, how do you get people to do what you want them to do? We're not really talking ethical matters here, although that's an interesting discussion as well. We're talking about when you have a site and you're supporting some activity on the site, how do you get people doing that activity more and more? So the first and primary thing of importance here is to tie behavior to identity. So what I mean by this is that in your social web application, if people can do they can behave, and it's not tied to their identity, then they essentially are not responsible or cannot be held responsible or accountable for what they do there. An example of this made explicit is on Amazon.com, where people who write customer reviews, they actually have a feature that says real name. And so Amazon essentially has said, okay, what we found is that when someone uses their real name, that gives a little more authority to that comment. Now, if you look at the second example here, which is written by a customer, on the face of it, that's less valuable because that person isn't necessarily using their own identity. So it could be the case that the second review is more valuable. That's certainly possible. But if someone's scanning through all the customer reviews and they're looking for ones to read, they're much more likely to read one from someone who actually has their real identity there. An even more interesting case is the eBay feedback profile. On eBay, of course, billions of dollars are exchanged every year from people who never meet face-to-face. So this is a core social design problem. And eBay has been tremendously successful at creating an economy around this. In fact, eBay is so big that it's bigger than most countries. And so the gross domestic product of eBay is, one of the largest in the world. So eBay has this really sophisticated design of their feedback profile, which allows potential buyers or potential auction people to make an assessment of that seller. And this assessment is based on the behavior, the history of behavior of that seller. So you can see they have like a feedback score, positive feedback percentage, so you can get a quick view. But then they go into amazing depth of each transaction that this seller has been a part of. So eBay essentially is saying this person's identity in the system and this person's authority in the system is tied to their previous behavior in the system. And on eBay, it works really well. And another interesting note about eBay is that eBay doesn't use real-world identities in the same way that Amazon did. When you have an interaction with someone on eBay, most times you don't actually know who they are or know their real name until after the auction is won, until maybe you're emailing back and forth at that point. So when you tie behavior to identity, it doesn't have to be their real world identity. It essentially has to be their system identity so that their authority within the system is known and their behavior within that system is known. It could be that this person is a really great person in the rest of their lives, or it could be that they're not so great person, but what matters is their previous behavior that is tied to their eBay identity. The second way to promote good behavior is to give people recognition. As we participate in groups and form groups and throughout our lives, we want to have recognition for the things that we do within those groups, and it's it feels good to be recognized. One of the sites, actually we have Daniel from Dig here. One of the sites that did this early on was Dig, and they came up with a feature called the Top Diggers feature. And this gave recognition to those diggers who submitted the most stories and got the most stories promoted to the homepage. But the interesting thing with the Top Diggers site is last February, they actually took the feature down. I mean, how many times do you hear of a web application team saying, no, let's take that feature out of the application? That would be quite refreshing in many of the projects I work on. It's always about adding features, feature creep and such. Do you have anything
Well, I was going to say,
why did you
I
take
totally
the top?
Agree with you, first of all, that more features should get taken away from websites.
So why did you take down the top diggers feature?
Well, I think that the top diggers feature made a lot of sense when we didn't have when we had a small to moderate size audience, and you know, people, you know, we're trying to teach people, like, well, you know, what's good about Dig, and one of those things is to get to the homepage. And it became, you know, Dig's in a large part a gaming type system, and so it's really fun to play, and so this was like, you know, the scoreboard of how well you're doing at the game. And once you reach a certain threshold, that becomes much less useful and becomes much more competitive in a negative way. And so we found people were trying to get to the top of that list by playing the game very aggressively with each other, and it became much less interesting to the huge corpus of users who weren't near the top of that list, and it became, you know, very competitive for a small group of users at the detriment to the mass. And so, you know, instead we kind of were debating in house whether either to make it a much more transient list or just to axe it altogether, and we ended up, you know, taking down the list. I think it was a good decision.
Okay.
But at the same time, I think we'd make the decision to keep that feature at the beginning. Just because we took it away later on, I don't think it was a bad idea to put it in originally. I think it was a very good idea.
Okay, so you build up momentum and then kind of taper it off.
Right.
As
I think
you get popular.
Adapt as you grow. I think there are certain features that just don't survive a certain threshold of use.
Okay, great. So kind of in general, recognition in kind of the top diggers list and similar features, it seems to work better when the recognition comes from the group. For example, on Dig, because the top diggers feature was a result of their cumulative activity over time, it was much easier for the people who were already in the list to stay at the top of the list than it was for other people to get onto the list in the first place. So recognition is great when it isn't permanent. You have to kind of refresh the value that you're adding.
Right. At the same time, you want it to be meaningful too. You don't want to just be on top this week kind of thing and feel like, oh, I've always got to be
right,
running and running and running to stay up there.
Yeah.
So there's certainly a balance there. Yeah.
Yeah. A site that does exactly that, not just a week, it's over a little longer period, is Threadless. Threadless is a site that allows designers to create t-shirt designs, upload those t-shirts, and then other people from the community vote on which t-shirts they want, which t-shirt designs they want made into t-shirts. So it's a great way for those designers to get recognition, but the recognition is essentially over when the contest is won. So they get paid a little money, their design gets actually made into a t-shirt, so they get great recognition. But that recognition tapers off relatively quickly until they decide that they want to try to enter another contest. So another way to encourage good behavior is to show causation. This is a very, very basic idea in interface design, and I think, but I think it's underutilized in most designs. A great example of showing causation is on the Netflix website. Netflix is great for many reasons. One of the reasons is that we all know, that most of us know how it works. It's, you know, it's very pervasive. You talk to most people and they know how it works. And one of the reasons why everyone knows how it works is because Netflix continues to tell you on every screen how it works. They show causation all over the place. For example, in this screen, the Movies You'll Love screen, they tell you no less than 4 times that rating movies is related to getting better recommendations. So they drill this into your head. And of course, it's good for Netflix because the more ratings they get over time, the better their recommendations will be.
And one of the best things about it is they're not even telling you, they're showing you how it's resulting. Because if you have to resort to the, you know, putting instructions and saying like, hey, do this and then we'll do that, you know, that's kind of lame, and you know, it requires a lot of thinking to see that. And
Pandora, I mean, also does a really good job of that. When you rate songs up and down on Pandora, for example, it tells you, you know, here's why we played the song, and then if you rate it, we'll play more stuff like it. It's really, really basic, but really effective.
Yeah, and even people who are used to the service, they don't. It doesn't hurt to tell them again to kind of reinforce that causation. Here's a different screen element on Netflix that is even more explicit than that first screen I showed you. This actually shows you 2 empty places where those recommendations will show up. So this is a great example of showing causation, in my view. The last point I want to make is to leverage reciprocity. Reciprocity is in academic circles, in psychology and stuff. It's incredibly core to all the research that's being done in social psychology, because reciprocity is essentially it's kind of a feeling that you get. One of the ways that you get it is when someone provides value to you, you feel somewhat obligated to provide value back to them. So classic case is when someone wants you to do something, they'll give you something first. They'll give you a compliment, or they'll give you a Hershey kiss or something, and then that just triggers this feeling of reciprocity. One of my good friends, Christina Woodkey, who works at LinkedIn, said that she pointed out that they have this great example of reciprocity on their site. LinkedIn, of course, is a social network, a professional social network for people trying to do job hunting and things. And they have this feature on the site that's called recommendations. And what LinkedIn has seen is that when someone gives another person a professional recommendation, the probability that they get a recommendation in return is insanely high, because you know, if someone says something publicly about you, then you're much more likely to then say something good publicly about them.
I think there's a very strong link too between showing causation and that reciprocal effect, because when you are able to show the person that a particular action came from, you're able to kind of allow a person to trace the thread of interest back to another person. And then to the reciprocal effect can kind of start taking over there. So those two kind of line up together. I don't think that you can have the reciprocal effect without having causation shown, especially in a social system.
Well, and in particular in this case, because the reviews are typically public, there's more of a obligation in a sense to return the favor, which actually can result in a lot of negative stuff, since then you get a lot of people going around asking everybody that they know for a positive review, or leaving, you know, hey, I really like this guy, he's got great teeth, you know. And then of course you have to like respond with something like, yeah, I like his lawn. I mean, it's so.
Yeah, both that example and the one that Dana brought up introduced this idea of a threshold, that certain features are really great at encouraging behavior, but then at some point, some threshold, the tide begins to turn. So whereas the top diggers was great at pushing that initial, you know, competitiveness and activity on the site, at some point it then started to become worse for the overall good of the group. So there's this notion of individual usability, right? How usable is the site to me personally? But then there's this idea of group usability. So how useful is the site to the group? So the feature of top diggers was insanely valuable to the top diggers, but it was axed in favor of the usability of the group. So to wrap up quickly my section, tie behavior to identity, give recognition, show causation, and leverage reciprocity.
So Daniel's computer didn't want to talk to the screen, so we're sharing one computer to do two sets of slides.
Very good at this. Okay, I wanted to talk about a really specific topic today of privacy and community and the relationship between those two. When I first signed up for Facebook, Kevin was, this is right after they opened up, you know, instead of just being for colleges, you know, anybody could join. And Kevin Rose, who I work with at Digg, was bugging me, saying, hey, these guys are doing some awesome stuff. You really need to sign up and check this out. And so, you know, I went and signed up. It's a great site. Like, I use Facebook all the time, and you know, I think their designers are fantastic. And so I signed up. And the first thing I did is, of course, I went and found all my friends, and then a few of my friends came and wrote on my wall. And I've never lived in a dorm room, and I wasn't familiar. I'm not even sure if they have this in Canada. I'm from Canada. I'm not even sure if we have the concept of the wall in our dorm rooms. And so I didn't understand the metaphor at all. And so it's just this messaging system, basically. And the first thing I did is people sent me messages, and they're like, hey, welcome to Facebook. It's really nice to meet you. And then I went and I was like, oh, I read that, and then I deleted it. I deleted all of my messages in my thing because I'd read them already. It was just an inbox for me, right? And so it was incredibly antisocial behavior, right? Because, I mean, the whole point of the wall is to, you know, talk in a big group, and here I am just using it in a personal way. And so I think that's a really good example of, you know, the importance of understanding privacy, because the privacy in one way is a very introverted idea. It's, you know, I'm keeping control of my information, and community is such an extroverted idea. It's, you know, I'm participating with a big group of people. But in order to actually develop a real community that is built on trust and, you know, is actually healthy, it requires a real balance between, you know, understanding privacy and that allows you to join the community in a trusting way. And so this has been a really interesting idea at both Dig and Pounce, so kind of both my jobs, and in very different ways at some point. So I made this very, very scientific-looking graph to explain one idea so you can believe in its truthiness. So I think it's kind of interesting that at one end of the spectrum, you've got very, very private sites where it's quite easy to understand at that end of the poll that, okay, like Basecamp, for instance, you have to sign in. It's very clear, you know, who's got access to what information. And so, and Pounce is very much at that end of the spectrum. When you send a message out, it's either to all of your friends and only those friends can see it, or I send it out very explicitly to the public and then, you know, everyone can see it, or I send it to an individual person. So it's fairly clear cut at that end of the spectrum. And then at the very far end, you've got very open sites like Get Satisfaction, for instance. If you guys are familiar with customer service site that Lane Becker and Thor have started, and it's very, very public. Everything you do there is pretty much all seen by everyone. You know, there's no such thing as private messaging within Satisfaction. You know, everything happens out large in the community. You know, Metafilter, you know, group blogs are very similar to that. And Dig is way at that end of the spectrum. Almost everything you do on Dig is public, and that's very intentional. There's only a handful of things on the whole site that aren't public, and those are the areas where we've run into kind of complexities of privacy. And in between there, there's all these different sites, and I think they fall across the entire spectrum. And Facebook falls right in the middle of that. There's some aspects of Facebook, like the wall, which are very, very public, and you have to, you know, once you learn that, you know that all of your friends and sometimes your friends of friends can see it. I'm still not always clear on that distinction. And then there's a private messaging system, and then there's your news feed. And there's I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I think at either end of the polls, you have a lot of clarity in terms of what's private and what's public. And so you have a lot less difficulty in explaining that. And the closer you get to the middle of the spectrum, I think you have to be a lot more careful in what you're doing and a lot more explicit about who's receiving what, because there's a lot less clarity. So when we're talking about privacy, there's a whole bunch of issues of privacy. I'm going to talk about a few things that are very specific to social networks. And there's... I think one of the important things to understand privacy is to think very much about your users and what are the hot points for them. What are the things they really care about in terms of privacy? One of those things is their online identity, right? And within that, it's really important to think about, you know, which parts of that identity are important to them. You know, which parts do they really care about the privacy of? Their image, for instance, that's usually a fairly public thing. You know, when you're just searching a site, you can pretty much see anybody's, at least a small thumbnail of their image. Something like their name, even that carries, it's really loaded. You know, the person's name is you know, their key, your key mode for identifying them. And on something like Dig, we originally didn't even require you to enter your name. And we've since focused more on the social aspects, we started asking people for their names. But at the same time, we very intentionally left the field quite open. And you can call yourself whatever you want. You can be Superman if you want to be. I mean, we don't even require first name, last name on Dig. You know, it's very open. And Pounce is much more about people than Dig. It's much more about, you know, because it's direct communication between people. And this has been kind of an interesting, contentious issue on Pounce that we originally were very much, I think we swayed very much toward the private side of things. And unless you had a mutual relationship with somebody, we're actually only showing your first name and your last initial. And in some ways, that's great because the because you know you can stay private if you want to be, and you know only after you search for someone and added them as a friend do you get to you know see more information about them. But at the same time, it's a bit limiting from a community aspect because it's more difficult to identify. You know, if I go to Chris's page on Pounds, I can only see his friends by first name last initial, and I may or may not recognize them because you know I might only know you know somebody you know. You know, Josh just by his last name, and you know it's hard to identify him. So we're trying to strike a real balance there, and so that actually goes into one of the other funny things that's a hot point is the people's social networks themselves. And this is a very, I find this still kind of a strange issue that on most social networks, and for good reason, we allow everybody to see everyone else's friends because it's fantastic for growing your community, right? I mean, if I'm able to go in and say, oh, I'm friends with Josh, I bet I'm, you know, his friends are my friends, I can go through his entire social network, which is extremely different from the real world. I mean, it'd be very bizarre to run into someone on the street and suddenly know, like, hey, they're friends with all of those people over there, you know? Like, so this has been, you know, this is part of the reason why on Pounds we had the first name, last initial rule is that, you know, we've tried to strike the balance between, you know, basically your right to have a bunch of friends and not share that with everybody. And you can actually, within your controls, not allow anybody to see your friend relationships. But by default, that's on. And then another big issue is communication. So, you know, what you're saying on the site. So this is something else that's really important to be clear. On Dig, for instance, we implemented this shouts feature, and we very intentionally called it shouting because it's, in almost all cases, is very public, and we didn't want to give you the idea that, you know, when you post something that, you know, it's only to that one person. You're actually posting, it's similar to the Facebook wall in that sense. And even then, even calling it shouting, even showing it on your profile and being able to see it on everyone else's profile, this has been a major area of contention. A lot of people have sent messages that they thought weren't going to be seen by the world at large and suddenly are shocked that, you know, oh my God, you know, people are reading my messages to other people. And we're like, well, it shouts, you know, you think that's clear, but, you know, obviously it's not. And, you know, they're not to blame. It's the system's clear, obviously not clear enough for them. And then another issue that I think this one's going to be very contentious for a long time, I think, is tracking people's site activity. In some cases, you know, like on Dig, for instance, when you dig a story, we're very careful to show, you know, there's this little tab that says, you know, who dug this, and you can go through every single person who dug that story and identify them. And so most activities that you do on Dig that are available publicly, and there's lots of them, you know, like obviously if you make a comment, if you vote on a comment, you know, all of these things are available publicly to other people. You know, your friends, for instance, can see which comments you voted up and voted down. But tracking site activity, like this is where like Facebook Beacon, for instance, it starts getting difficult. I mean, if I went, you know, it was a couple months ago to Fandango, which is this, you know, movie ticket buying site, and I bought tickets to, I think it was No Country for Old Men, which is fantastic if you guys haven't seen it yet. And it was very bizarre. This thing pops up at the bottom of the screen and says, hey, we're going to post this to your news feed. And I'm like, I didn't even know I was signed into Facebook. I don't want to share this with my friends. And, you know, that's just an activity I did on a completely different website. And so I think that's obviously this has been a very contentious issue, you know, and it's been discussed a lot by people, you know, where this is really crossing a certain barrier. I think that type of interaction is going to become a lot more of a hot topic over the next few years. Because, I mean, in some ways, that's a great feature. It's really useful. But on the other hand, you know, we're starting to track a lot of your online behavior. And one of the big things is we're consolidating it all in one place. And so that's even been interesting on Dig, or we're thinking about doing some of this stuff on Pounce, is aggregating some of the, you know, the public information you do. And all of that information is out there, but up until you aggregate it into a, you know, logical context, you know, it requires a lot of effort, and it's, you know, kind of privacy through obscurity.
I think people are sort of developing a bit of a gut level sensation about what is stats tracking and sharing that, and what is just tracking your public behavior. Like the fact that I dug a story is a bit of public behavior that's being shared, but then suddenly when something that's more of a statistical nature, that when that gets shared, it feels like it's a little bit more invasive because it's not something that you did as necessarily a public act like buying the tickets. What they did was they took that information, they took it away from you as a personal act and made it into a public act, and they just kind of let you know that it was going to happen. It didn't sound like you had a lot of control over that sort of thing. And I think when we hit those points where something feels like a statistic is being turned into something that's being ascribed to us as an intentional act, then we start to get into a realm where people don't feel as comfortable with the system.
Absolutely. And so one of the ways to overcome this, and I think this is really important no matter what social app you're building, is to build in controls. So build in ways that people can control access to their information. But you really want to be careful to make this as simple as possible. It's very, very tempting, and this comes up all the time. There's one specific person at Dig who all the time will come up with awesome feature ideas, and then I'll bring up some concerns about privacy or complexity. And he'll go, well, we'll just put that in as a preference. That's a really, really dangerous road to go down, and I'd be anytime you ever come up with a crutch of making something as a preference, I'd be extremely cautious about it. I mean, this is the interesting story with this is the rise of Firefox over SeaMonkey, which was the old Mozilla suite. And one of the big reasons for that was that they got rid of almost all the preferences. I mean, developers used to love SeaMonkey because it had 5,000 preferences and I could customize it to hell, but almost nobody used it. And then, Firefox came out and they boiled it down to the core set and gave you, maybe a dozen features, Chris?
Yeah, basically.
And it turns out that's really what people wanted. And I think we're at Dig especially, I think we've already started going down the road too much of providing too many options. And it's not that people don't want that level of control, but once you add, you reach a certain threshold, people don't understand their options, and then they have no control. And Pounce is also approaching this, and I think it's something, because it's a fresher, early project, it's easier to nip this stuff in the bud. And I'd encourage you, if you're building your site, to, from the very get-go, it's much harder to take away preferences once you've added them than to control them in the first place and, add them as you see the need.
How do you actually prioritize, though? I mean, one of the things that you have going with Pounce right now is that it's very, very early. So the number of features and the number of things are actually resource constrained. Whereas for Dig, you've been out there for a number of, years now, and people have become familiar with the system. They're asking for more and more functionality, I imagine, even things that you guys have probably thought about before and shot down. Obviously, you need to continue sort of adding, unfortunately, going through the Microsoft Word process of adding value by confusing things, but it's to appease those folks who have been there for a while and are like, I'm kind of bored with this. Give me something new and interesting. But that also, of course, costs you potentially new users.
Well, I would hope we never have features to alleviate boredom. I mean, that's...
Isn't that what Dig is? I mean...
Well, sure.
I love Dig.
But I
love you.
I did like Josh's concept earlier of taking away things before you add things, and I've definitely been thinking about that a lot lately, and I do realize the idea of feature creep. I mean, it's very tempting to keep adding stuff and adding.
Let me give you another example, outside of Dig or whatever. I mean,
sure.
Recently, Automattic hired the guy who built this social network being built on WordPress called BuddyPress. And this raises the question of WordPress so far has been a great sort of publishing platform for a lot of people for blogging. But as it moves into social network functionality, you start getting into the Drupal kitchen sink model. So obviously WordPress kind of has maybe a destiny somewhere, but if you're in that situation where it's continue just building a basic publishing tool that anybody can use to, we see all these features that everyone's using, why don't we just build those in? How do you balance those trade-offs?
Well, I think one of the big things is to kind of hide some of the complexity, right? I mean, it's very fun to add some features, particularly a lot of these, the more complex features are of a specific interest to a very niche group of people. And it's interesting to put some of that kind of under the hood where it's not immediately discoverable to the new user, but as they grow to understand the system and become more involved in the system, suddenly they realize that underneath of that there's all this extra goodness. Mm-hmm. And that way you're keeping the site simple on the surface, but as you become more confident and you kind of build up that experience and that interest in learning more. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
gradated, I guess.
Facebook's really struggling with that too. And their profiles over time, they had so many features, they had so many applications that you could add that you'd go to someone's profile, and there's just way too much. It became just an overload. So they recently, I think, hit this threshold you're talking about, And now they're having like a tabbed profile where they have some information on three different pages to alleviate that strain.
And so the last thing I wanted to talk about was the importance of transparency. I think this is, you know, incredibly important. And I think one of the interesting things what Josh was alluding to is the idea of, you know, preferably you show and don't have to tell. And so something like on Pounce, for instance, when you make a post, we list all of the recipients with that post, and those are the people who are able to see it. And when you make a reply, those are the people who can read your reply, and no one else can. And then if you make a public post, we go even further than that. We actually do tell you, and it says, you know, we're exactly in context where you're going to write the reply. It says, you know, this is a public post. You know, anybody and anyone can read this. You know, so when you make a reply to that, you know, your stalker, your mother, you know, who are not the same person.
Speak for yourself.
Speak for yourself.
So, you know, you should understand, particularly in the context where you're contributing to the site, who's going to see that, you know, who's going to see that activity. And, you know, in some cases that becomes complex, and in some cases you can make it quite clear, like the who dug this. You know, the idea is that you can go and see the pool, and even if you don't see your own vote in there, you're like, oh, I can see Chris and I can see Josh, and, you know, I know if I'm going to hit that button, my name's going to get added to the pool too. And so, you know, the more transparency, the better. So summing up, if you're building a site, if you lean more towards either being very public or very private, you'll have more clarity and more simplicity overall. And it's not saying you have to do that, but it's something to think about. When it comes to people's personal information, be nuanced and be sensitive to what's important to them. That's going to be different for every single social network. It depends on what you're sharing, you know, what your demographic is, and this could be different. You know, it could be quite sophisticated depending on how big or how complex your site is. I mean, there can be different pools of people who care about very different things. Give control to your users about, you know, what information they're sharing, what's public, what's private, but keep yourself limited. Don't use it as a crutch. And be transparent as you can, and especially try to show transparency instead of telling people about exactly what's going to happen. So now we will try to do the switcheroo on one laptop.
Switcheroo.
It's always interesting looking at other people's desktops.
It is.
I don't know why.
Is it still up there? Is it showing?
Oh, we can see your whole dock.
Can you? I can't see my dock.
We can see a spray can.
I can't see anything.
I think that's a...
There you go.
Okay.
Yeah. Except that I can't see it.
That's my presentation.
That's yours.
Do you want to open your display preferences and do mirror displays?
What I'm going to do is I'm going to just quickly do this.
Someone's Twittering this.
And if they're not, they should be.
Okay, one. We're close.
We're close.
It's getting there.
How do we look?
We good? We're getting shaking heads.
No.
Let's give it time to warm up. While we work on that.
Okay. So something that I'm going to be talking about is an issue that afflicts many social software systems as much as it has email, and that is spam. And with Magnolia, when we opened up our doors, we didn't really give too much thought to what would happen just by making it available to everybody. And one of the first things that happened was that people found us with intentions that we really didn't expect to see, but we completely understood them when we saw them. And that was something that we're familiar with, and that's spam. So we embarked on a long and winding trail of trying out different ways of managing spam, controlling it, stopping it, fighting it, however you want to describe it. We found what we think is a fair balance of solutions. And I'll talk about some of the issues that we faced while we were doing that. So regarding spam, we all know that it's a drag, but it's not only a drag on our attention, our time, our sensibilities as we're offered things that we might find disgusting or completely irrelevant, but it's also a drag on our efficiency. It's a drag on the technical costs of developing software for the web, and it's a drag on a community as they're trying to find their way through a sea of information with the help of your software, and then other people are getting in their way and showing them things that they have no interest in whatsoever and they're actually offended by. Spammers, however, don't feel the same way. They really love social software because they see it as real individual endpoint consumers who are just ready to buy that Cialis. by the way, I have a great deal. Our tools, the tools that we love about the web right now, the tools that are so great for us, APIs, being able to import files, being able to share things with each other, these are also the things that spammers are loving as well. They love APIs because then they can programmatically do their work. They love being able to import files because then they can do things en masse. They love being able to track their actions across history and to see the effects as they grow because that's educating themselves on how to be more effective. I don't want to say marketers because it's not marketing. Some ugly numbers. 75 to 80% of new accounts that are made on Magnolia and many other sites too are made by spammers. It seems like a shocking number. And it is. It's really surprised us when we started doing some calculations to find out how many people we were seeing as we started to sort of separate the field that so many were coming in. And sometimes they're using robots to do this. And I'll talk a little bit later about what we've done to counter that. And in other cases, they're just kind of sitting there at night and doing one after the other. And in even more cases, they're paying people in lower economies to do so for less than pennies. And we'll talk about that as well. So it's out there. It's very vibrant in the social web. It's not a problem that's by any means solved in any one space. Different architectures of software and how you set up a social system will be either more friendly or less friendly to spam. But you don't want spam control to become something that you start cutting off your nose to spite your face for. So the methods that we've been using, or the methods of spammers, sorry, that we've seen, the way that the kind of taxonomies of spammers, a few months ago Larry wrote a post about, he kind of did an expose on what's going on with spam inside Magnolia and what we've been doing to counteract it. And he came up with a nice little taxonomy, and I've grabbed most of his classifications of how spammers work. And one person will often just have one site, and then they make many, many accounts and link to that one site. And they're hoping that with coverage across a lot of different profiles that there can be the appearance of popularity. But more so what they're looking to do is to get into the mechanisms that the system uses to promote material to the top, much like in Dig or in Metafilter, anything like that. And they're looking to game that up so that it will appear somehow in front of more eyes. The next type of method that we've seen spammers use is where they take one or two legitimate looking links, and what they'll often do is look at people who are featured on the site or people who are very active on the site, and they're definitely legitimate linkers. They'll take their last three bookmarks and then they put them in their own, and then they fill up the rest with Squidoo or something like that to sort of kind of give this very, very loose, threadbare semblance of legitimacy, and then kaboom, there's a ton of spam right after that. The third type is something we call Joe SEO, and this is the person that we have some sympathy for because it's a person who's found a spot online that's told him he's going to get rich quick if he just opens up a little store and or if he just starts following these methods, a lot of which are going to social bookmarking sites and adding links to their great little bead shop or something like that, and that they can get rich while they sleep. Unfortunately, there's even a mythos built into how these people are communicating with Joe SEO, telling them that what they're doing is not advertising, what they're doing is not marketing, and what they're doing is certainly not spam. What they're doing is helping people by sharing information. And it's kind of sad because people really do feel that they're doing something that's fairly positive in the world, or at least morally neutral, where it's not good or bad, it's just what's going on. They're not realizing that what they're doing is really creating a tax on people's enjoyment of the site, the way that we develop the site, and they're making trouble for people without even realizing it, hoping that they're going to get rich. And the real tragic thing is that they aren't going to. The next, second to last one is you can't fool me. These are the people who, they are very profile aware. They put a lot of work into making a profile look substantial, looking like it's a real person. And, I mean, there are real people behind it, of course, but they try and make it look like a member of the community. so much where they'll actually copy and paste stuff from other people's profiles. These people are trying to use the appearance of legitimacy as a person to lend credence to the quality of their bookmarks and get people looking through them a little bit more, just hoping for enough impressions that a click might happen and maybe a sale. And finally, we have people who import links en masse. We wanted to make it easy for people to come into Magnolia to bring bookmarks that they already had with them, because what good is it having bookmarks if they can't travel with you? Unfortunately, what people are doing is making long lists of bookmarks, and then they import them, and if you combine that technique with something like one site, many accounts, where there's a lot of different accounts, then they can slam those bookmarks into almost every account that they have, and before long, one person could easily have 5,000, 10,000 bookmarks that are all pointing back to the same places. So these are the kind of methods that we've seen at work, and it's quite a wily problem to get around because, like I say, you don't want to start cutting off features that really do work and are really good for growing the community just to take care of spam. So one of the big things that we realized was that we weren't going to win a war. We weren't going to extinguish spam. We were going to have to accept the fact that it's part of the ecology, it's part of where we are, and it's part of the game that we're in, and so we're going to have to learn a way of playing it that minimizes its damaging influence and at the same time keeps things positive for the people that are there to use the service in a good way. I'll start by talking about what didn't work. NoFollow, which was started by Google, I think, 2 years ago, something around there, was a way of trying to beat back against some of the link farms that were going on. By adding NoFollow, what you're really telling Google to do is to ignore the destination of this particular bookmark. And by adding NoFollow, we were hoping that we might start taking away some of the incentive. If people weren't seeing their page ranks go up for those links on Google, then they might start abandoning social bookmarking as a way of trying to promote them more. It just doesn't seem to have an effect. There's either too many sites that don't apply NoFollow, or they're just not looking at it in a way that's pulling that pattern out to them, that it's having a detrimental effect on their spamming.
We once did a focus group at Dig once, and we were showing the new profiles we were designing over the summer, and we had a couple guys who were like define themselves as SEOs who were there, and it's really interesting to get their input directly. And the very first question they asked was, "Are you putting NoFollow on the links you can add?" And we're like, to have to deal with that. It's like so frustrating.
You don't even want the question, but if you can handle the question with the person, maybe there's a chance to educate somebody there and to let them know that you're interested in that. Maybe you're looking at the wrong place. Maybe you're looking at the wrong way of reaching somebody. Maybe you should really be looking to appeal to their interests and their humanity rather than just talking to them enough to make them buy something so you'll shut up. The next method that we tried was we tried another technological method and something a lot stronger this time. We tried the Akismet spam fighting system that's been really fantastic for WordPress. And what we found was that we were applying Akismet at the account level. So when Akismet would scan a list of bookmarks and thought that it started to see some spam, then it would flag an account as a possible spammer account. What we were finding was that technique of few legitimate links would start sending Akismet into kind of a wild back-and-forth sort of interpretation. And so at the account level, it didn't really work out too well. We found that we were doing more post-processing of Akismet's work just to kind of double-check and make sure that it wasn't really adding up to a savings for us. And in fact, it was starting to kind of cloud the situation. Granted, Akismet wasn't made for this purpose, so we were trying to repurpose it a little bit. And maybe with some more work, it would have gotten us there. But we decided to not focus so much on a technological solution, thinking that maybe we do need human intelligence to help us here. And that's when we started to get into weeding on site. We built a few small tools to hide accounts. And what we did was, if a person sees an account, they can just click a link and they can hide it. Now, that was something that we only did for admins. And then that moved into a new program that I'll get to very quickly because I know I'm going a little long here. We recently added reCAPTCHA. It had almost no effect whatsoever. What we found is once again that people are paying people in lower economies for sub pennies to go in and do the human work of adding the account. So the things that do work, except that there is no 100% win. You're going to have to deal with spam. If you go into it fighting a war that you're going to win completely, you won't get there. We did start a program called Gardeners, and what Gardeners does is it empowers members of our community who have shown themselves to be very passionate and trustworthy with that ability to hide an account. And that leaves us with a whitelist with a shade of gray. When new members are coming into Magnolia, they're graylisted. We don't know if they're spammers or if they're linkers. But after the gardeners have had a chance to look at them, they are able to kind of categorize them, and only whitelisted accounts have bookmarks that show up in public areas on the site. The other bookmarks are still there. They're just not visible in public searches. So it's very much like Flickr's NIPSA or not in public search algorithm. About the gardeners very quickly, like I say, we've enabled trusted members of the community to move people off and on the white list. It's very important to be able to go back and re-decide later. It's not a job, a contest, or a vendetta. And pretty soon we'll be able to allow gardeners to make other gardeners so that the system will be able to grow organically, very nicely touched for gardeners, but in a way that the solution can grow in proportion to what people are perceiving the problem to be. So the bigger spam gets, we can add more gardeners. If they aren't needed, they just don't have to do the work.
What's the reward for gardeners?
The reward for gardeners is simply knowing that they are contributing to the community.
It's altruistic.
It's altruistic,
like
completely.
Fire department.
And it's also, I think there's a bit of satisfaction, too, in being able to do something about what you see as a problem on a site. A lot of times, as visitors at a site, we see a problem or we see something that we want to change. It might not even be something about the feature design. It's just an activity going on that we don't like. And being able to have an impact that's quite substantial with respect to that one single account could be very satisfying to a person who is actually helping other people avoid having to look at that kind of problem.
Yeah, I just wanted to push back a little on the term altruism. I haven't met anybody like that.
No?
I haven't met anybody who's actually altruistic.
In person?
You haven't met Alex Jones. Here's a gardener.
I mean, the idea that you do something without absolutely any recognition or anything in return it's very rare. To give an example of some research that I did, I was doing a project for a restaurant review site, and we went in thinking, you know, because I always get questions like, why do people submit reviews to like Amazon, or why do they submit reviews to restaurant review sites? Why do they submit reviews to Yelp and things like that? And one theory is that they're altruistic. That well, they just want to help other people. And there's certainly a sense of that, and so in doing actual reviews with people who use the sites, they often mention, you know, I really like helping people. I don't want people to make the same mistakes that I did, or I really want to tell someone that they need to have this certain dish at a certain restaurant because it's such a great dish. But then, when they answer that question, that would be okay. They're altruists, but If you don't ask a follow-up question and just wait for their next answer, you'll hear something like, you know, I really like to see the number of people who are reading my profile go up. You know, I like to know that people are getting, I like to know that people are seeing my reviews. There's a site called Yelp, and they have a reviewer of the day. So they give recognition for those people who do reviews by you know, showing their face on the homepage. It's a little bit like Dig over time. But I'm wondering, are there other aspects to it? Like, is there some perhaps public recognition award for being a gardener?
There is some public recognition, but pure altruism I don't think is the case, actually, because the people who are using Magnolia are using it as a tool to help themselves quite a lot. They care a lot about the information and the quality of the information that they're going to find in there, because they're not there to waste their time. By helping cleaning out spam, or at least hiding it away, they're not only helping themselves by making sure that it doesn't appear in front of them again and disrupt their path of trying to find something that they're looking for, but then it's also that impetus to making sure that somebody else doesn't get troubled by it. Like you were saying about the reviewers, somebody doesn't want someone to make the same mistake that they did. We're sort of giving gardeners a way to enact on that as well.
Should we take a question?
Yeah, sure. Hi, Alex.
Not sure if this is on. There we go. So I'm actually one of the gardeners.
And to be fair to Alex, he didn't know I was going to do this.
Yeah. Excuse me. My voice is going a bit. Oh, even better. Altruism is a part of it, but it's also, in large part, there's a sense of ownership. So I was lucky and kind of discovered it really early on. And I just happened to create a group about web design, which all of a sudden got really popular. I mean, imagine that. It's a website for geeks. First discover it. So there was a little part of me like, okay, I want to keep this group clean because I have some ownership of it. But it's also, I want to make sure that what is out there is good and high quality because I really love the service. I don't want it to go down the route I've seen so many other places go. So the key thing is, as a gardener, they've made it really easy for me to give back from a site that I get so much from. So it really is a balance, and really good services understand the fact that, for me, I don't really care that my picture is up anywhere. I just care that I have a really good service that I can rely upon, and I feel like I have a responsibility to give a little bit back to. So that's a key thing for me with Magnolia.
Well, we appreciate it, that's for sure. There is a little bit of recognition for gardeners. They can be identified on their profiles. There's a small shovel beside Alex's name there. Gardeners have that. And eventually he'll be able to give that shovel to someone else to make a new gardener. So those are the techniques that we've used. I would say that the big takeaway for us from that whole experience has been to really look to the people in your community for help. Just because you're being their host doesn't mean that they can't help you fix up the party decorations and clean up a little bit after all the fun's over too. But also don't only look to technological solutions to these things. Sometimes you do need to tap into human intelligence to make things work well.
So we're actually close to the end, which is kind of sad because we were hoping to have a lot more conversation and questions. But I guess, I think that we probably should just do the wrap up. You know,
sure. Sure. Time for a couple questions.
We could try.
Yeah,
let's try it.
Yeah,
it's very hard for us to see out there, so yeah.
Is there any? I know there's an effort of companies to try and monetize network sites right now, in addition to using ads. Is there any legitimate way that they're doing that, or is everything through spamming or that nature?
Well, I think that there's legitimate ways to do it. Magnolia, for example, does run ads against some of its pages, and it's largely about how you place those ads and what content that you're going to allow to be shown there, whether or not it's in accordance with the type of service that you're trying to design. Does it fit the experience, and does it fit the community? Does that answer the question for you?
Yeah, pretty much. I just wanted to know if these network sites are going to be used more and more by companies.
I think that people are looking for ways to do it. None of them know exactly how, but that's why you're seeing Facebook look at things like Beacon and so forth as ways of monetizing against
them. A lot of the monetization of social sites is, and it needs to be indirect. So it's making the members of a community perhaps allowing the passionate ones to get more recognition, allowing them to bring others into the fold. It's not that their participation is going to, it's not like you can set up a system where every time they do a single thing, there's money in the bank. It's building the culture of your community and supporting the culture. So
right. And get the community excited, and the community do your marketing for you.
Yeah.
Right. And so they'll eventually buy more of your stuff or whatever service you provide, but that revenue won't come directly from their participation in the community site, but it will be a fallout of their increased passion in the way you let them express it.
All right, so next question.
We're actually getting pulled off the stage, Chris. We got the axe.
We got the axe, the chop.
Can we agree to meet somewhere so we can talk with people about questions?
Sure, we can meet right out the doors if anyone has any specific questions or any topics of contention.
Okay.
So thank you.